Talk Radio.
I am actually pretty angry this morning, and I've been angry before, but never really as angry as this, because this, to me, is complete and utter balderdash. It's cobblers, it's rubbish, it's nonsense, it's lots of other things that I can't say on the radio.
What do you make of this new variant, Stanley?
This new variant was obviously detected in South Africa, and we should be grateful to the virologist, it seems it was a woman, virologist, who has first described, isolated it, and characterized it. The reaction to it is the same absurd reaction as when, I don't know if you remember, when the British variant came out. And there were bans on travel, banning people from the UK coming to the US because of that new variant. And as I've said then, and I'm saying now, these people merely detected it. It's a mutation. Viruses mutate in certain ways, no matter whether it's in South Africa, in the US, in Holland, or in Indonesia. I am sure that once this has been described, we're going to find out in some of our virus stock preparations from months ago that this variant is already in a lot of countries. The mutation occurred in the virus, in the genetic code of the RNA. And I'm sure it not only occurred in South Africa, it also occurred many other places. And just like it was absurd to say that there was a British variant, and let's try to ban travel from the United Kingdom. In fact, it popped up everywhere, the same variant. And the same way this Omicron variant, which was first described in South Africa, we're going to find out that, it's going to happen everywhere else. Travel bans and lockdowns are really unscientific right now if you know about mutations in viruses.
Well, you seem to be suggesting that this variant, by some form of magic, is simultaneously occurring in different parts of the world. Surely it's just a mutation that then spreads. It happens in one place and then it spreads.
No, not necessarily. It could happen in one place and then spread, or it could happen anywhere. As a matter of fact, right now, if you in Holland, I think some scientists have said yes, as from our viral stock preparations that we've stored here, we have that variant. It's been in Holland for 2-3 months prior to its description in South Africa. So mutations are, happen during replication. They are thermodynamically driven during the reaction by the RNA polymerase inserting the wrong nucleotide. By accident, some of them render the virus totally inactive. Obviously, something like that would not be naturally selected for. But a mutation which occurs and that gives the virus an advantage, such as, and here are the advantages a mutation can give a virus. Number one, make it more transmittable. And number two, making it less morbid. In other words, by making the virus less, with lower morbidity, making the person who catches it less sick, he is more likely to transmit it than the person who's very sick and has to stay at home. Another thing to understand about viral mutations, which create new variants, is that in a question in serial passage, you have trillions and trillions of viruses, billions of generations, that for a higher multicellular plants or animal would take billions of years to occur, can occur within a month in viruses. Because you have as many generations in a month, for example, with a virus, that you would have in a billion years with humans. Or a million years with humans. So these mutations happen. They happen randomly, and they get naturally selected if they confer an advantage to the virus. And as a matter of fact, as I have said, they are now seeing this virus pop up in other countries. It didn't come from South Africa. In Holland, they say they have had cases. Now that they are analyzing the genetic map of this new variant and comparing it with what they have in stock, they can see that they had that virus months prior before it was described in South Africa. So yes, it can travel from South Africa and spread, or it can happen, the same mutation, in another geographical location. And what makes a virus, gives a virus the advantage, usually the natural selection is for less virulent and more transmissible.
Yeah, well, we keep hearing that Omicron may be more transmissible. What we don't seem to be hearing on the TV or on the radio or in the newspapers is whether or not it's actually more dangerous, which seems to be in many ways, just as important as how transmissible it is. But isn't there a slight problem here in that this sort of variant may have actually been caused by the vaccines, so that as the virus realizes, human beings are immune to the original type of me, that I'm not really getting very far, that these, just purely as you're talking about by natural selection, other similar viruses that have mutated are likely to be more successful and spread around the world simply because of the vaccines.
Well, the premise that the vaccines causes mutation, it's not cause and effect. But what the vaccines accomplish is that they're giving people, vaccines that give you one monoclonal antibody against the virus. So any mutation that changes that receptor site on the virus sufficiently so that this monoclonal antibody is no longer effective will obviously be selected over the one that's susceptible to that monoclonal antibody. And that selection would be made especially among the vaccinated. But there will still be mutations in the unvaccinated. They may be, of various types. So, yes, the vaccines that they have designed now will, obviously help select for variants in the population. It's not like the virus is thinking, well, you know what? There's this, I'm going to change that way so that... No, these are random mutations and that will be selected. And it's, an indubitable truth that, yes, the vaccine will help select for viruses that change their receptor sites, for mutations that change their receptor sites.
Well, I'm thinking about some of the countries which have decided to have a zero COVID policy, like New Zealand and China. It almost seems impossible because, as we know, with things like the cold and the flu, almost whatever you do, these viruses find a way to carry on.
Well, let me, on that subject, instead of just postulating, recommend that, an article just came out on The Lancet showing that the vaccines have not reduced the number of transmissions. You can find that article in The Lancet. I've posted it on ResearchGate today. And obviously some people have argued, it's a very interesting thread on ResearchGate.net, a conversation that I started about a year and a half ago. And some people have criticized some of the things I've said, and I've answered them and, showed them the scientific arguments for the things that I've said. These articles, the last article in The Lancet, I just posted it, and among some of the articles that are references, is one where they show that in 68 countries and in the United States in about 2,600 counties, vaccinations have not reduced the number of, quote, cases that are being detected every month or every week. There has been no reduction in the number of new cases being detected after vaccination as compared to before vaccination.
But I mean, surely these vaccine manufacturers like Pfizer and Moderna, they don't guarantee that you're never going to catch or transmit COVID. What they're saying, surely, is that you're far, far more likely to escape hospitalization.
Yes, that's what it's based on. And what I've just told you does not contradict that claim. Though, I haven't seen the scientific evidence for that claim since they've been complaining that we're having another emergency with intensive care units all over the world being filled up with new variants or with the original virus. And that sort of argues against this reduction in hospitalization, because if there was a reduction in hospitalization, and I'm not going to argue the point because I don't have the statistics in front of me, one would not hear that plea from, our authorities here in the United States or Mr. Boris Johnson in your country saying that there's a dark cloud over the continent. Obviously, vaccination should have reduced that dark cloud into a more friendly cloud after such intensive campaign to vaccinate with those, again, let me stress, with those vaccines that received emergency use licensing before they have gone through all the stages of experimental proof, which has been used before a vaccine was allowed. An interesting case is the Association of Healthcare Workers and Medical Professionals, who asked the FDA in the United States, FDA is the Food and Drug Administration, for the data and documents that was used to license the Pfizer vaccine. The FDA has refused to release all of it. It seems it composed of over 300,000 pages of documents, and the FDA has cavalierly proposed to release 500 pages a month of the documents that they have used, which means it would take approximately 55 years before they release all the documents and data that they have used to license the Pfizer vaccine.
Well, I mean, hang on, Stanley. That's pretty shocking. I mean, this should be just basic public information. This is the evidence that has been considered that proves that a vaccine, this particular Pfizer vaccine, is safe for use. And that should surely be in the public domain. There's no excuse, there's no reason to keep that secret.
Well, yes, obviously. And that's exactly the statement that this group has put out, that it's unconscionable that you refuse to put it in the public domain when in the United States it's calculated that the number of people for whom the vaccine will be mandatory, that work according where there's more than 100 employees or government workers, from postal workers to any government agency that will be required to take the vaccine, you're talking about 100 million human beings who will be forced to accept an injection of a vaccine without transparency. It's a bit unusual.
Well, it's very unusual, particularly since this is a public regulator. You would have thought that they would be demanding to make sure that this information was made available to the public who are paying their wages. I find that very strange. I mean, now you've brought up this subject of mandatory vaccines. We've now seen in Europe, first of all in Austria last week, and now in Greece this week, vaccines becoming mandatory. Even a 100 euro monthly fine for anybody over, I think it's over 50 or over 60 in Greece, who has to have, they must now have their vaccine. There's no choice for them. What do you make of that?
Well, the same thing I make of the United States. I've noticed that there have been a lot of people resisting this, whether in Austria or in Holland. But it doesn't seem to make any difference to the governments involved or the European Union Parliament. And it's really kind of shocking. I think, you know, to ask that something be obligatory, you know, under the law, without releasing and I have to point out, not only that, but most of this data that those big pharma, whether it's Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, have provided, especially, and I know for Pfizer and Moderna, have provided to the FDA, whatever research was funded with public money to begin with. Their research and development was funded by public money. You have the new pill coming out that Merck is putting out, which is a nucleoside analog as a, you know, antiviral agent. Now, that's fine. I don't know how effective it's going to be. It's, like I said, a nucleoside analog, which means that the RNA polymerase of the virus will pick up that molecule instead of a particular nucleoside to build up the RNA of the virus, therefore making it defective. But the important thing about that is that before even the effectiveness of this pill has been shown, we don't know to what degree it's going to be effective, the Biden administration, just like the Trump administration before it, no difference, has given 1.18, In other words, almost $1 billion, $200 million to Merck. And it's the same thing we had seen with Moderna and Pfizer back in 2020 under the Trump administration. It seems to me that it really makes no difference what administration you have in the United States, whether it's Democrat, Republican, or Trump, because it seems Trump was despised by both Democrats and mainstream Republicans, but it really made no difference. The big pharmaceutical companies get what they want.
Well, interesting, isn't it, that this is all government funded, taxpayer funded as well. But look, you know, what you've got with these vaccines, Stanley, is, you've got something which is being mandated now. I suppose you might say, well, where is the control group? Because if everybody is forced to have a vaccine by law, you end up with having no control group. In other words, the people who, for example, I've either chosen not to have a vaccine or for some medical reason cannot have a vaccine. So surely from a scientific point of view, it's quite important to have a group that you can compare the vaccinated to.
Well, that is once the vaccine has been licensed, then suppose that you don't need a control group because that had already been done. That's why it took it took 7 years before, and I've said it before the polio vaccine was approved, both for efficacy and for safety, where they tested it on thousands, hundreds of thousands, compared to hundreds of thousands not vaccinated as a control group. But this is supposed to be done before it is licensed for use. Once it is licensed for use, we can no longer talk about a scientific control group. It almost becomes, irrelevant. The thing that's remarkable is that the vaccination programs that have been going on around Europe, Asia, America, have not lowered the number of cases, the transmission rate. They say that it was supposed to lower hospitalization rates. So with such percentage in the United States of vaccinated people and in Europe, we shouldn't hear politicians saying that there is an emergency, all of our intensive care units are filled to capacity, and that there's a dark cloud hanging over humanity. The vaccines should have given relief, some relief, and we should not be in the same position that we were in the darkest period during 2020 as far as the SARS Corona 2 story goes. Now, myself personally, I don't believe we were in such dire predicaments in 2020 because we had something that had a very low mortality rate in the general population. We had to protect our senior citizens. But anyway, this is how the story unfolded, because according to, the governments concerned, we were in dire straits back then, and it seems we still are. So the logical question to ask is, well, what good has it done? What good has been all that money spent and all these people vaccinated with, the vaccines that we don't have the full data as to why they were licensed to be used in the first place.
Okay, but what about the medical ethics behind mandating these sorts of treatments, especially since this is an emergency use authorization for what is effectively a massive experiment, which will be going on until it's completed in 2 years' time in 2023?
Well, I mean, I don't know what you mean about the ethics. I don't think it, you know, I think general sense of panic was instilled, and the public accepted it, and everybody. One thing for sure that it accomplished, this is indisputable, is that the largest transfer of money from the people's wealth to the very few in the pharmaceutical industry, that it has accomplished. Take a company, my favorite example is Moderna, a company that had not even produced an aspirin for the market yet, whose value went up $16 billion. We're not talking $16 million or $600 million or $1 billion, $16 billion, and whose you know, major shareholders, who were the CEOs, made personal fortunes out of. As a matter of fact, there was a story that at the end of 2020, that most had sold, you know, CEOs of Moderna had sold $100 million worth of share for their own personal gain before the vaccine was even on the market. And I guess that's how a free market economy works.
Wow. But what about the look? I mean, you know, doctors like you have been trained, Stanley, have got surely got ethical red lines. And I'm a little bit concerned that mandating an experiment might be crossing some of those lines.
Well, that's, you know, that is something for the as they say, the state of the arts of each country to determine. If the people accept it, then it becomes ethical. If the people don't accept it, then it remains unethical. I mean, that's, you know, the old saying, vox populi, vox dei. Well, if the people don't, you know, accept it, then it becomes ethical.
Okay, I wonder if you could go into some of the differences between the different vaccines. So we're talking about the traditional type, polio type vaccine compared to these modern mRNA vaccines and the adenovirus, which I think is AstraZeneca type of a vaccine, because it's starting to become an area where, you know, we're having to make some quite important choices now, as we're told potentially the COVID vaccine will go on and on, you know, so you'll have to keep having every few months or every couple of months another one. We as individuals who are accepting these treatments or not are going to need to understand it a bit better. So can you just take us through the differences between these different types of vaccines, Stanley?
Well, what came out in 2020 is this new idea of an mRNA vaccine. It's with the advances in genetic manipulation and genetic techniques, it became possible to take part of the genome of the virus, of that RNA virus, the segment of its RNA that codes for the spike protein, the receptor site of that virus, the attachment site, I should say, of that virus to your cells, and put it in a small lipid enclosure held together with ethylene glycol and use it as a vaccine. And the idea is that they put that little piece of messenger RNA, that's why they call it mRNA, they inject it in your muscle, and the cells of your muscle where it's injected take that mRNA and translate it into the spike protein, that attachment site of the virus, and your body makes antibodies to it, so that when the virus comes along and you get exposed to it, and then your body can already make a response, already has antibodies to that attachment site of that virus, and keep it from progressing as as a major pathology. In other words, nip it in the bud, because you already have antibodies to the attachment site that the virus uses to attach to its target cells. These are like the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. What the Russians did, and AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson emulated, is that they took that messenger RNA, reverse transcriptased it into a DNA, and inserted it in the DNA genome of the adenovirus, whichever type. They each use different types. AstraZeneca used the monkey adenovirus, even though there are about 29 different types of human adenoviruses. And I'm not clear as to why. And then they use that adenovirus as a vaccine. And supposedly the same thing happens. You translate. The main difference is that that mRNA cannot freely circulate in your circulation because it's enclosed as DNA in an adenovirus. And that's really the main difference between the existing vaccines. The Cubans and the Chinese have done other things. They have taken the protein itself, the structures themselves, put them in an adjuvant solution and use that as a vaccine. Now, the traditional vaccines that we have are more like that, or say the polio vaccine or the smallpox vaccine, are attenuated whole polio viruses or a pox virus. And that is used as a traditional vaccine. And the reason it's harder to have variants, for example, of the polio vaccine, and that's why for 50 years we eliminated polio. You know, polio was considered eliminated by the World Health Organization, is one of the great successes of a vaccine. And variants did not immediately appear. Why? Because it's not one specific piece of mRNA from that polio vaccine that was used. It was whole polio viruses, either attenuated or dead, depending on whether it was the Sabin or Salk vaccine. So you didn't just do one monoclonal antibody. Remember I talked about monoclonal antibodies that you make from that mRNA vaccine? So you had many different types of antibodies and T-cell activations. So whether humoral antibody or T-cell, killer T-cell, you had T cells and B cells who make the antibodies primed with different parts of the virus. So it would take multiple mutations, not just mutation changing one spot in an attachment site to make it defeat the immunization. In other words, people who have received the polio vaccine, you know, make different types of antibodies and different type of T cell, killer T cells towards infected cells.
Well, it seems to me there's a serious problem with this so-called advanced technology, in that it actually will only apply to, as you call it, a monoclonal antibody, to one specific part of this virus, whereas the traditional vaccines will apply to all of them because they contain all of the virus as part of the vaccine. So it seems to me as if, Stanley, I mean, you know, this is just trying to take a step back, looking at this almost from the moon, you know, that actually this is a step backwards, not a step forwards in vaccines.
Well, that's what I think. That's what I've been saying, you know, since they were proposed back in March and April of 2020. That's my point of view. Of course, they're not a step backward as far as being able to produce them more rapidly and more profitably, which is what is important to the pharmaceutical industries.
What about for people who have autoimmune diseases? I know this is something you and through your lifetime of work have been working quite a lot with autoimmune diseases like AIDS. Those families that have you know, maybe have a bit of history of that in their grandparents, their parents, should they avoid vaccines? I mean, are vaccines potentially going to be more problematic to them? And particularly, I suppose, these sort of new mRNA vaccines. I just wonder whether people should be a little bit aware of looking into the potential dangers of an mRNA vaccine if they have some sort of autoimmune history in their family.
Well, Tony, this is not anything new. This is something we've known about for a long time, and it doesn't have to be just the mRNA vaccine, because even with the smallpox vaccine, people who were immunologically compromised, not even AIDS, this is before the HIV virus, which used to completely destroy immunity. I'm talking about people who had partial immune deficiencies or who were born with immune deficiencies. When they were vaccinated, they caught a disease and they gave it a name. It was called vaccinia. It was smallpox caused by the vaccine. So yes, obviously people who are immunologically compromised should, you know, they could still notice that the mRNA vaccine is not going to infect them with a virus, but it will be useless if they're immunologically compromised as far as giving them immunity. So yes, people should be aware that if they are immunologically compromised, if they have suffer and they have a history of autoimmune disease in their genetic history, an mRNA virus can cause autoimmune diseases, because the idea of mRNA vaccines is for your own cells to produce the antigen, and for your own, which will migrate to the membrane, to the cellular membrane, and appear as foreign to your immune system. And therefore, you produce you know, antibodies and attack these cells that are producing the viral antigen from the mRNA. The idea is that they say the mRNA vaccine stays locally in the muscles and does not go to other organs. But it's very hard for them to explain the myocarditis and pericarditis that we've seen as, you know, becoming more and more current among vaccinated people when they receive the second dose. And it's been reported by many hospitals. The only way to explain that is if, you know, the mRNA has migrated to organs like the heart, and some of the heart muscles produce the antigen, which causes the inflammatory response from the immune system. Now, if the most probable organ, apart from the local injection site that would pick up that mRNA and start making antigens, the you know, the spike antigen would be the liver. But the liver, it will take time before we know if, you know, such, you know, such pathologies occur, because the liver is a big organ and it takes time before, and many infected cells before you can detect it. Whereas with the heart, it's more more problematic, more immediate.
I mean, it does, you know, does seem to me that there is a sort of, you know, almost a diametrically opposed approach to this with some people as against others, almost a religious kind of difference. I mean, I hate to use that word, but that, you know, there is almost a religious aspect to it with people that's faith is either in the medical industry to come up with a solution rather than, you know, maybe working with the body's own immune system. So, for example, you know, taking things like traditionally we take for respiratory diseases, which is vitamin C, you know. So you, what you can do is you can actually help the body's own immune system along, give it the building blocks it needs to fight whatever disease there is. I mean, vitamin D apparently is also quite important. But there, it does seem to be almost like a religious difference between these two approaches, Stanley.
Well, look, I don't think they can argue the fact that, that helping your immune system is a very good regimen to give it the building blocks, as you say, to have a healthy immune response to anything. But diseases, infectious diseases, are usually caused when the immune system is overwhelmed. And that's since, you know, the beginning of history. That's why we've had plagues and things like that. And that's why we're thankful that certain things like antibiotics came along. Immunization, especially in London during the smallpox epidemic. And for example, simple thing like chlorine, the chemical chlorine, which has helped eliminate a lot of waterborne diseases. And even indirectly has helped in the fight of that great scourge of the South, which is not prevalent in Europe, but in the very important in, you know, the global South, malaria, because the mosquitoes, the mosquito larvae is killed by very low chlorine concentrations. And the great cholera epidemic of London in England would not have occurred had water been chlorinated. So we do need help. Our immune system does need help. I'm not one who says all medications is no good. No. As an immunologist, I can tell you that immunization has saved countless lives. Antibiotics have saved countless lives. like I said, a simple chemical like chlorine, has saved countless lives. But just like we see with bacteria, that natural selections select for bacteria that have mutated to be resistant to some of antibiotics. We get, penicillin resistant bacteria. It's much easier for a virus to mutate and become immune to a monoclonal antibody. It's much easier to do that than for a bacteria to mutate and become penicillin resistant. The first penicillin resistant bacteria had to make a very complicated gene by accident, by, random mutation, but it was immediately selected for, that they made penicillinase, an enzyme that destroys penicillin. And yet we saw that develop in nature. So it's not very surprising that we're seeing, variants in this coronavirus.
My point, I suppose, is that we've seen very little governments or the press pushing this whole idea of helping along the immune system, including things like, these treatments which are available, very cheap, some of them, like ivermectin and chloroquine as a potential antiviral to... in many cases, certainly the evidence seems to be that these cheap little pills, can make a difference between whether someone is hospitalized or not.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's not our own immune system. Something like ivermectin, and if you want to come, I was among the first to say that ivermectin should be used as treatment and perhaps even prevention of this respiratory virus, this coronavirus. There's a lot more evidence in vitro and in vivo with ivermectin being a good antiviral or chloroquine being a good antiviral agent than there is with this new Merck pill that's going to come out, which is a nucleoside, like I said, analog. Do you know what other nucleoside analog was used against COVID-19?
No.
Well, remdesivir. Remdesivir was an adenosine analog, and did very poorly, to the point where now, after it made billions, and I mean billions, after Dr. Fauci recommended it, and it became standard treatment at $12,000 a treatment for every hospitalized person, it was declared, and nobody made a big stink about it, notice. It was declared about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, which I also posted on ResearchGate. It was declared totally ineffective and no longer recommended for COVID-19. And yet, I don't see any public outrage about that.
Well, that's amazing. Something that's so ridiculously expensive is used, whereas something that's very cheap, like ivermectin, is not.
Not only that, something that's cheap and effective versus something that was extremely expensive and proven ineffective. That's what's outrageous. But, what can one do? I've tried to give that message since mid-2020, but nobody listened. Now, not all nucleoside analogs are ineffective. We have a good nucleoside analog that's used against herpes virus that has, you know, good success, from moderate to good success, whether it's genital herpes or shingles, or, and I'm talking about acyclovir, a molecule that was developed in the 70s. It's a nucleoside analog. It's a guanine analog, which is used in DNA viruses, you know, and it does fool the DNA polymerase of the herpes virus into incorporating it at an acceptable rate. When that happens, the virus particle becomes ineffective. It's no longer a viable virus. But for the RNA virus, like the coronavirus, remdesivir, and they knew that remdesivir wasn't effective because they had tried it back in 2003 with the first SARS outbreak. Severe respiratory syndrome, Corona 1, if you want to call this one Corona 2.
Given that these vaccines contain adjuvants, we did talk about that a bit earlier on. I've been chatting this week to a guy called Professor Chris Exley, who has just had to leave his job at Keele University here in England because the university have basically blocked his only method of funding through charitable trusts and private donations, which he was doing reasonably well, keeping his research going into aluminium. And I noticed that it was when he started really probing into the effects of aluminium contained in vaccines and the effects on the body, that he lost his funding. So I just wonder what you make of two questions here, really, Stanley, for you. One is whether these aluminium in vaccines make sense to you, how it operates, what it does, and secondly, you know, the effect of aluminium on the body.
Well, I'm not an expert on the effects of aluminium on the body. Obviously, as they say, so a certain concentration just shouldn't be there. It's not natural. As far as aluminum being in adjuvants are things used to make an immunizing agent or a vaccine, if you want to call it vaccine, more effective to elicit a greater immune response. The adjuvant that I've worked with is called Freund's adjuvant. I used to use it to make rabbits and goats make more antibodies to the thing that I needed antibodies. I would inject the rabbits with the virus that I first isolated with Freund's adjuvant to make them have a better response, to get a greater antibody titer, because I needed these antibodies so I can see where the virus goes inside the, you know, in the cell. And I illuminated them, you know, conjugated them with a fluorescent molecule so that under an ultraviolet microscope, they would shine. But we always knew that Freund's adjuvant was too dangerous to use on humans. I don't want to talk too much about, first of all, what they're using as adjuvants in some of the vaccines are still not part of the public domain. Some of them are intellectual properties. Perhaps that's why the FDA does not want to show the documents that they use to license the Pfizer vaccine. In general, one should be very careful about what you're injecting into your body. And I think this professor you're talking about, who's seeing, you know, dangerous levels of aluminum in the vaccines, is very important. But I'm not, you know, I'm not an expert at that, so I don't want to say anything that I, you know, that's not 100% so.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, what about, I mean, it just seems to me a little bit illogical that you can inject aluminium into somebody which makes the vaccine work better. So is the idea that the body sends its cells to attack this foreign aluminium or whatever that adjuvant might be, and it accidentally they then start bumping into bits of the vaccine, and then that does what they're supposed to do, and it wouldn't be attracting the body's immune system to that area enough, so you have to put something which is also, you know, toxic in there to get the body to basically send it all, you know, it's like sending the fire brigade, you know, to sort it out.
Well, like I said, I don't want to comment, but I can tell you that aluminium in its, you know, in its basic form, an atom of aluminium will not elicit an immune response. It's simply part of the cocktail, the adjuvant cocktail, and there's too much of it. It is toxic, and there's too much of it. But aluminum on its own, you know, aluminum molecules will not elicit an immune response at the, you know, at the molecular level, at as like they say, colloidal aluminum will not elicit an immune response. Just like, I don't know if you remember, when it was found that silver, colloidal silver, could be effective as an antiviral. There was a time it was all the rage to take silver as therapy against infectious diseases. It had a bit of success, but I've never researched it completely myself. But the silver itself did not elicit an immune response. If it was part of a cocktail of an organic molecule, of an adjuvant, yes, then it would.
Yeah, anyway, so finally, we've had an interesting decision made last week in the UK from NICE, our regulator here, or one of our regulators, saying that antidepressants should never be used as a first form of treatment for people who are presenting to the medical profession with depression. Now, I mean, I think it's pretty clear most from most of certainly my experience chatting with people over the years that these antidepressants can be sort of handed out like sweets, really. You know, oh, someone turns up to the doctor, they say, oh, I'm not feeling, you know, very good. I just feel depressed. And they say, oh, take some of these. But they're saying that now, Stanley, that this is not a good idea and that that they should never be handed out as the first form of treatment of some kind from a doctor. Only if, nothing can be done about this depression, maybe they should be then considered. Anyway, what do you make of these antidepressants?
Well, I agree that they should not be the first thing handed out, and they are handed out like candy. I've been proposed by my doctor to to take Zoloft, I think it was, which I didn't. I find that exercise and physical exertion is a much better antidepressant than any chemical can be. When you get what they call a runner's high, it's the best form of antidepressant that can exist. But antidepressants are being handed out like candy. And just like we have the opioid epidemic, we do have an antidepressant epidemic going around. The reason that we don't see, you know, a reaction to that is that some of the people taking the antidepressant, you know, like their antidepressant, they're addicted to it as much as the people who take opioid painkillers are addicted to the, you know, to the opioid molecules. But definitely something else should be tried first before these antidepressants are given. And there are much better ways to try, you know, to treat depression, in my humble opinion, because I'm not a psychiatrist nor a psychoneurologist. But in my experience, you know, exercise and activating other interests are better, you know, cures for depression than the existing antidepressants. Just like it's very hard for people to come off of opioid addictions. They can become the, you know, psychotic if you take their opioids away all at once. And these were being given like candies. And by the way, it's interesting to know that Pfizer, that we're supposed to take their word for it without all their data being made transparent and in the public domain, the data that was used to license them, has just paid out $2.4 billion in damage for the opioid epidemic. I think it was about a month ago that the judgment was handed out. I'm sure they're going to appeal. They're going to go to a court of appeal and et cetera. But Pfizer was just fined by a lower court $2.3 billion.
But actually, $2.3 or $2.4 billion is not a lot of money for Pfizer. They see this as simply a cost of doing business, an acceptable risk.
Yeah. If you look at the statistics, and the last time I looked at the statistic, that was about the yearly average that the pharmaceutical companies as a whole pay out almost on a yearly basis. I'm talking about all of the pharmaceutical companies put together. So there must be what is an astronomical sum, $2.3 billion, seems to be an acceptable risk when, you know, over $30 billion has been made in direct sales and in stock enhancement once one of their medications is approved.
Okay, Stanley, well, fascinating to chat again. Can you just remind us where people can find some of your work online and follow some of your research?
Sure. As far as the COVID-19, because I'm now retired from, you know, active research, but as far as all of the points of views and arguments presented by other scientists, I would recommend to go on ResearchGate and see a conversation that I started about a year and a half ago, which is entitled, Why Did Fauci Not Approve Chloroquine as an Antiviral? And it's a very long thread. It has many, many, including some comments by some big pharma hitmen, as they say, but it's very interesting, and they can see there my, you know, some of my work, including theoretical work about immunology, and also the detailed research that I did to discover the new retrovirus that I discovered.
Okay, Stanley Lehane, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.